Can I email from there?
I was finding last week.
We'll work out how to get it off later. Wait, as long as you don't have to send it to me like 25 3-minute bits. Yeah, like, someone wants to record. Someone says, I'll record the Sierra Alpha Manning. And I got these like 18 emails, each of like 3 minutes.
That way
I'll
record it for me.
Oh, yeah? If you're that girl, then I forgive you. If you're listening on the internet right now. Okay, fine. Let us begin. We are talking today about art, aesthetics, and idolatry, and how they go together is an interesting question. I'm not going to talk too much about the idolatry, although it's a very fascinating halachic sugya and a topic in and of itself, although it relates to it. I'm going to talk a little bit about it at the end. I've given you a sheet that has more sources on it than we can get through, because I'd rather give you a more complete package that you can always go into at other times. But let's start off this issue here. Does everyone have the source sheet? Yeah? It's clear that art and beauty are a very important part of Western life. From the Renaissance onward, the Renaissance, of course, being the rebirth of the Renaissance.
It will never get old.
The Renaissance, which was, of course, the rebirth, that's what the word Renaissance means, is rebirth. It's a rebirth of what? It's a rebirth of classical art, classical values, classical architecture, classical being Greek art, literature forms, theatre forms, poetry, etc. So from the 14th, 15th century onwards, going through the 16th, 17th century, you have this reignition, if you like, of a focus on the value of beauty and art and aesthetics, which of course was central to Greek life. This comes back into Western thought. Therefore, I feel that this is a topic that we need to deal with. And how does Judaism value this or look at this? Now, the general position which most people, I think, present on this is fairly negative. We're not that into art and aesthetic issues and presentation of these things and the modern day genres of theatre and cinema and all of these things. Why are we not so into them? Well, apart from anything else, a lot of these things do present halachic problems. There are obviously going to be halachic problems with some art which involves nudity or different kinds of inappropriate images which people shouldn't be looking at, maybe women as well, but certainly men. So that's going to be one issue. There's going to be art which is religious art, which is communicating religious themes of different kinds, mother and child, and Christian art, and all sorts of things like that. So that may be also problematic. We'll talk about that. There's a lot of sculpture. Sculpture in and of itself is a problematic halachic issue. Just having, maybe even owning sculptures, certainly making sculptures of human beings, we will see, we'll touch on that at least at the end, is going to be halachically problematic. So apart from anything else, there have been a whole number of halachic pitfalls to being involved in this, and therefore we were just never involved in this at all, and we seem to shy away from it. Therefore, if you ask most Jewishly religiously observant people today what Judaism says about beauty, you'll get a pretty negative response most of the time. I want to try and present another side to that, and also look at the halachic issues a little bit as well, and see what we have to say here. So the first part of the shiur really is more a hashgafic analysis up to the end of source 11, let's have a look at that now. So there was an interesting discussion recently I'm part of an email kirub group, and a rabbi wrote in and said, I'm giving some shirim on beauty and Torah, like, does anyone have any sources?
Should he know that he's a rabbi?
No, actually I don't agree with that, because a lot of people, there's a lot of cross-fertilization of ideas. Not everybody has access to all the sources. I gain tons and tons from other people's shirim, and other people's, like, what we think we know everything. Of course not. Rabbis definitely share ideas and information and resources. That's fundamental. But what's interesting is that there were no responses to this email that I was aware of. I actually just wrote to that rabbi himself, and he said, did you get any responses? I just wrote this afternoon, so I don't know what he's going to say. The one response that I saw that went on the email was the Pasuk in number one, which is that this presumably is a Jewish response. Sheker Achein, Behevel Hayeti, Ishi Yiras Hashem, Hiti Talal, which you all know is kind of the climax of the book of Mishlei. We normally know it as Eishes Chayil that we sing on Friday night, which is Sheker Achein, Behevel Hayeti. So what is Yoti? Yoti is beauty. Hevel, what does Hevel mean?
Worthless.
It's worthless, futile, vacuous, vapid. Is a good word I think we should use all more. Vapid. Okay, it has no value. It's no intrinsic value, and that is one response that I. And there was a very nice piece that I saw a video of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who was interviewing people, of course, not interviewing, but seeing people, speaking to people, like he did, and he gives them a dollar bill and gives them a bracha first. So there's a nice video on Chabad, on one of the Chabad sites, of Miss Israel. From 1990-something, went to visit the Rebbe and asked him for a bracha that she should be matzliach. She's in the competition, you know, Miss World or whatever it is. And she said, you know, I'm Miss Israel and I want you to help me give a bracha. And he actually engaged in a whole conversation. And it's on video here, it's on the Chabad website. And he said to her, you know, here's your, I wish you bracha, matzlocha, and mazel, and here's the dollar bill. And he said, and and you should make sure all the other girls in the beauty competitions know that Yiras Shamayim is the key, and you should tell that to all the organizers. They're not going to have much of a competition left. But it's interesting that he engaged her with this, and he introduced her to this idea. Now, that I think is totally, he doesn't need my haskama, that's for sure. But that clearly is correct in the context of Miss World, meaning, what should we praise women for? Well, how beautiful are they? And he's saying, no, that's not correct. Look in number two, the Matsudas David on the Pasuk says, Sheker Achein, okay, Chein Ha'isha, the grace of a woman, like how impressive she is to people, V'yafya, and her beauty, Hein sheker v'hevel, they are nonsense, they are falsehood, and they are empty. Rotzalem, what does that mean? Not that the chein and yofi are intrinsically empty things. Because we know that, by the way, that chein is a very important thing. So that Yosef had chein in the eyes of her, and Esther had chein in the eyes of people around her. We say, v'nimsa chein v'seichel tov. Yeah, we ask, we daven for chein. But he says, actually, what these things are is Rotzaloma, Ein Behem To'eles Rav, they don't have really much impact. Adra Halel Esa Isha, that's what you're going to choose to praise a woman for. Be'elit, for these things. Meaning, say something positive and important about this woman. She's beautiful. That's all you can say. That's all you can think of. That's all you can see. The Yofi. No, Adal Isha Yiras Hashem, Hi Haru Uya La'alel. But, meaning, that if the context of this pasuk is not that yofi is worthless, says the Masudas David, but that if you want to pick something to use as a way to describe or praise a woman, that it's highly superficial and inappropriate for you to use beauty as that thing. So I think it's important to understand that before you wheel out the pasuk hevel sheker achein hevel yofi, this is not a pasuk that deals with yofi in an abstract sense, with beauty and aesthetics. It's a pasuk that deals with women. And that's why the Rebbe said to this girl that at the end of the day, if you want to be in a competition for how to be a high quality woman, then it shouldn't be a beauty competition. And I would have hoped that everybody in this room agrees with that, and most people probably in the world agree with that as well. So that's what the pasuk's about. So what does the Torah say about yofi, if it's nothing to do with, specifically to do with women? A few things. We see a lot of positive things said about beauty in the Torah. I'll bring you a few. Number three, Mitzion, okay, Nichlal Yofi, talks about Tzion being the ultimate in Yofi, beauty, the ultimate beauty, Elokim Hoti. God will come out, will appear in Tzion, which is the ultimate example of beauty. Take this off.
The air's
not
on.
Do you want the air on?
Well,
I think it might make it hotter because I think it's so to heat.
Make sure there's the snowflake and not the fun.
Yeah, I don't think it helps.
I think she's right.
I think the whole system is set to heat. Anyway, not for now.
Did you change it?
No.
It's got the snowflake on. Do you know that every single shiur that's recorded on the internet has about 8 conversations about the temperature in the room? You know that? If someone was to ever decide to write an analysis or critique of Rabbi Manning's thinking, what is the theme? What is the resounding theme of his thought? Like, I'm afraid that I think that would have to be the can you summarize Rabbi Manning's thought?
Yeah,
it's fine. It's good. No problem. Now listen. We see in a number of other places, for example, with Leah.
What's the matter?
Nothing.
Don't stop it.
Oh, no.
Good.
Okay. You see in other places with Leah, the Ene Leah Ruckus, Leah's eyes were weak on some level, soft. But Rachel had to give back to Abi Yafel. Rachel was beautiful. She had a beautiful face. She had a beautiful physique. These are things now, and maybe that's something that is spiritual beauty. Okay, that's possible as well. But it's not necessarily like that, because if you look in the Midrash number 5, it says, Ve'elakam na'im Rachel. No one was more na'e than Rachel. Now, I should have brought you the context here. The context of this Midrash here is the bracha that you make on seeing exceedingly beautiful people. Okay? And if you look for a second number 6, I come back to number 5. It says, Tana Rabbanon, Haraya Pil, you see an elephant. Kai. Okay. Or a monkey, things like that. Omer, Baruch Moshana Etzabrias. You make a bracha. We don't make these brachas today because we're so used to seeing. Still recording? I'll bring it over here. So that, yeah. We are so used to seeing all of these visual strange animals that we don't feel in any way impacted by them anymore. But in theory, there's a bracha on seeing weird looking animals. Moshana Etzabrias, just one second. God who makes different kinds of creations. Rabrias Tovus, if you see very beautiful things, people, Ilano Tovus, very beautiful trees, you say, Baruch Shekacha Loi Ba'alamai. You say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam, Shekacha Loi Ba'alamai, that such things exist in the world. That is a cause for bracha. And the membership number 5 picks up on that and says, Rachel was one of the most beautiful women that ever lived. And it says, Bishvil, back in number 5, Bishvil Yafya. Because of her beauty, because Yaakov Lisa Lesai. That's one of the things that Yaakov wanted to marry her for. Meaning, of course, he saw in her the future of the Jewish people and Midos and Lavan and all that, the Lavan's house, nevertheless, she was. That's the short truth. But the beauty that she had, and we're talking about a physical beauty as well, that was one of the things as a Medrash that was important and attractive in her. You had a question?
If you, I know that in theory we don't use the bracha, but if you were to see an animal that you've never seen before, like how there's new creatures that are being discovered or used or things like this, something you've never seen, they don't have it, could
right.
You make the bracha?
You could make the bracha if you really never experienced it before, and we tend not to make the bracha. You know, it wouldn't be like osa to make the bracha, but now it's very unlikely that you've ever come across an animal that you really have no idea existed and was like, sometimes like deep sea creatures, you see strange things, like, you know, whatever. Anyway, I'm not giving a halacha shir on when you can and can't say the bracha. I'm not giving any psak halacha now. We have to have a separate class to deal with that. But in principle, we see the idea that beauty is something which is valued. Yes.
So are we criticizing Yaakov for seeing that animal?
No.
No.
We're absolutely not criticizing Yaakov for that. The fact that she was Yafat Tuar is an important part of the whole process. If you look in a non-human sense, look at an interesting source in number 7 and 8. It talks about the Mishkan, okay? We're getting into Inyana de Yoma, Pasha Truma this week. We're talking about the building of the Mishkan. So it goes into extraordinary lengths to describe exactly how the Mishkan looked. And it says that with the curtains came down and there was like an overhang. What did they do with that sort of overhang or overlap of the curtain? It says like this, number 7. Ha'amazev, ha'amazev. Ba'oida, ba'orich riyos ha'oihel. Okay, so the extra ama on each side, there was like an extra length of curtain which would kind of drag on the floor. It says, yesaruach, was kind of folded back up. Al tiri ha'mishkan, mizeh, u'mizeh, on each side it was kind of pinned back up. It's sort of to cover up like the bottom there. Meaning, there was a whole kind of system as to how the curtain was pinned back and it was arranged, etc. What did the Pesukim deal with that? Why do I need to know that? Why is the Pesuk in the Torah, which where words are so precious and so carefully used, why am I being told that the overhang of the curtain was being pinned back in this particular way?
Look, you might like the core.
So look at Rashi. Yesaruach ha'tziri ha'mishkan. The Tzafonu Lederom, on the northern and the southern sides of the Mishkan, they mean the long ends. Well, obviously the Mishkan was rectangular. There were two long sides and two short sides. So on the long ends, the northern and the southern sides of the Mishkan, this is where the overhang was. Kemoshi Pirash Lemalai, as I've said above. Lamda Torah, the Torah is learning here, okay, or Limda Torah is teaching here, Derech Eretz, appropriate behavior. That a person should be concerned for the beauty, should not want to ruin the beauty. That the aesthetic of the Bet Midrash, of the Mishkan here, the beauty of the Mishkan is something that shouldn't be allowed to be sullied by the fact that the curtains are dragging on the floor and picking up dirt and all that kind of stuff. This is in and of itself important. Because Yofi is, in and of itself, important. It's an interesting source that I think people sometimes mess. Yes, yeah,
but is it, like, I guess that, like, it's saying, like, aesthetic matters, but does it mean that aesthetic only matters for, like, holy reasons?
So we'll see that.
Like,
we'll see that.
Have, like, a nice apartment.
So we'll see that. We'll see that right now. Who says that a nice apartment is not going to be a holy reason? That's what you use it for. Have a look here in number 9. Look at number 9. This kind of answers your question. Number 9. We see that Noah had 3 sons. Okay? Shem, Ham, and Yafet. When Noah and the 3 sons come out of the Tabor at the end of the story of the flood, so he gives them brochas. And Shem and Yafet get a brocha, and Ham gets a klal, gets a curse. So if you look at number 9, what are the brochas that he gives to Shem and Yafet? So he says like this. Yaft Elokim leYafet. Now, the word Yefet means beauty. He's called Yefet. That's the man's name. Yaft Elokim leYefet. Let God grant beauty to Yefet. Okay? Vayishkon ba'ole Shem. And he will dwell in the tents of Shem. What does that mean? Yaft Elokim leYefet vayishkon ba'ole Shem. And it's very interesting. There are 2 classical different ways of understanding this. Actually, I should have maybe brought them on the sheet. Unkelosen and Targum Yodosen understand this in different ways. One way of understanding it is as follows. Yaft Elokim leYefet, God will give Yefet beauty. The verb means but. But God dwells, Yishkan is he dwells, meaning God dwells in the tents of Shem. Meaning, Yefet has beauty, that's very nice. But where is their spirituality? Where does God reside? With the Semites. That's where the word Semite comes from, Shem. With us, with the Jewish people. Means the Greeks, and the Greeks, of course, Yavan, who is the grandson of Yefet, represent this idea of the aesthetic and the beauty, meaning you can have all the beauty you like, and you can keep it, but at the end of the day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is connected with the ideas of Shem. That's one way of reading it. That is the way, as far as I understand it, the Targum Yonason understands it. However, the other way of understanding it, which is, I may have got them the other way around, I just need to check them out, I should have brought them on the sheet, maybe I'll put them into the sheet, is as follows. Which is, no, it's not that God is dwelling in the tents of Shem, it's that Yefet is still dwelling in the tents of Shem. Meaning, Yafta Lukim Le Yefet, that God gives special beauty to Yefet when he dwells in the tents of Shem. Meaning, when is Yefet a brocha? When is beauty a brocha? When it can be twinned with the idea of Shem, with the ruchnias of the Jewish people or whatever that is. Then you have a dream team. You have Yofi, like in the Mishkan, like you're asking, Yofi, which is beauty, which is directed at a very holy end. In fact, there's a very nice, it's not a gematria, it's kind of just the way the words work, but the Yavan, which actually very interesting in terms of the word itself, at least in the way we write now, is a very interesting sort of structure of the way that the actual word works in terms of Yavan. And it almost has aesthetic appeal in and of itself. Which is fascinating.
But
that's very interesting. You're saying it's empty, has no base to it. I never thought about that. It's an interesting idea. Yeah, Hevel HaYofi. At the end of the day, Yavan has no base. But when you the tzaddik of Sitkas, when you put Shem in front of it, what does it turn into?
Zion.
Meaning, if you take the tzaddik of the tzidkas of shame, you add it to the yefet of Yavan, you create the idea of Tzion, which is in Kimi Tzion, Tzeite Torah, that the Jewish people will propel Torah to the world, etc., and it has a holy value. So it could be, you could definitely make a case for the idea that, that the beauty has to have a context, but when it has that context, then that's a kind of dream team. Rav Hirsch talks a lot about this, as you'd expect him to. We talked about Torah and Derech Eretz, and Rav Hirsch has a lot to say about the combination of yefet and shame being a very ideal one, and part of that is aesthetics and art and beauty as well. What I want to do is I want to show you now something about Rav Kook. This, I think, is a very, very beautiful Rav Kook, which we need to look at now. What is the concept of Tiferet? And this is also the idea of the Mishkan, especially the clothing of God. What does Tiferet mean?
Royalty,
harmony, sort of splendor. Usually it's translated as splendor. These words are very bad translations. Like, what does splendor mean? Something splendid. You know? The words are difficult to translate. Majestic, maybe. Look at number 10. V'asisa bigdei kodesh. You will make these holy clothes. The clothes have to have kedusha. La'aron achicha, for your brother Aaron. L'chavod u'letiforas. They are for kavod. Okay, a sense of gravitas. Kavod means kaved, means heavy. There should be a sense of seriousness to it. And also tiferes. So what does that mean, tiferes? So if you look in number 11, the Ramban explains, Sheyiye nechbad, it has to be honored, honorable, umufu'ar, and also this mufu'ar is from the word tiferes, like pa'er, b'malbushim nechbadim umufu'arim, in clothes which are honored and splendid, for want of a better word, okay, eila ha'begadim levushim malchusim, like levushim malchus, like the clothes of kings. What is the purpose of kings wearing these clothes? Now, often, he's the queen. Now, 9 out of 10 times in history, it's just their own personal ego and their own, you know, self-focus. But it also has a purpose in terms of spreading something to the people as a whole. And I want to show you this piece of Rav Kook on Tiferes, which I think will revolutionize our understanding of the purpose and function of art and aesthetics. And then I'll show you a really interesting extract from the Jewish Chronicle. I've never had calls to bring a piece of writing from the Jewish Chronicle. The Jewish Chronicle is a well-known newspaper in England and has been going for many, many years, and we're going to see the Jewish Chronicle from September the 13th, 1935. But first of all, we're going to see a Rav Kook. Tiferes Tzadikim Muflaim. The Tiferes of very great Tzadikim. Let's see what he says. And I already talked about the tzaddik in Tzion. So let's have a look at what the Rav Kook has say about tzidkas. Okay, fine. Default to the Rambam. Yeah, Rav Kook. Hatzadikim amuflaim. Okay, so have a look at the this. These great tzaddikim. And I'm going to read this in the modern Hebrew accent because it kind of reads better in Rav Kook. Okay, but don't laugh at my accent. She'ein olam hazeh tofes etzlam makom. Okay. That this world, his Hebrew is very complex, and I'm not the best person. I'd be better off if my son was teaching this to you. He'd teach you much better than me, because he knows much more about Rav Kook than I do. He should do. He went to Shiva there. But anyway, he says, "Ein olam hazeh tofes etzlam makom." This world doesn't, if you like, grab them. They don't have they're not rooted in this world, these great tzaddikim. They're not grasped by this world. Mitzad gvulav, because of its limitations. Shveluto, it's lowliness. Shapal means lowliness. The tzimtzumav, and it's tzimtzum, and it's restriction. Tzadikim are not bound by those things in this world. Dafka heim mokirim et olam. It's dafka because they're not bound by this world that they are able to appreciate this world umechabdim oto, and to give it respect. Interesting. The very people who are not immersed in it are the best place to actually see it for its real beauty, because they're not caught up in it. Such a Rav Kook way of seeing things. Mipnei sheheim roim bo olam elyon, because they see a higher level world. They don't see the world in its lowly state. They see a higher state. Ziv tahor, this splendor, this pure splendor, glow. Mimkor ha'chaim, from the source of all life, being a spiritual source. a godly source. Okay? The yafa, and its beauty, the tova, and its goodness, mik aleh is, is elevated, is the word. Be'iluyim gudolim, in a very significant way of elevation. Meaning, they look at this world with its beauty and its good, and they see it as a spiritual dimension which elevates it and elevates it. Let's have a look. The hargashat hano'am, and this sensation, this feeling of pleasantness, the yofi and beauty, shebo, which is in the world, okay? Mit gadelet etlam, it is enhanced and increased with them. The godel shel kedusha, it is given the sanctity, the adinut, and a certain adinut, a certain, what's the word adinut here, means a certain gentleness, a certain splendidness in the sense, well, elyona, on a higher level. Add until shehenon tamid chayim chaymelein, so that these people are able to live life to its full. Who are the very people that are able to get the most out of everything in this world? They are the tzaddikim who are detached from this world, who see higher purpose all the time in this world. Because these people have in them, or these aspects of this world have in them, all the shikui haleshed, leshed is the word to describe the man. It's this kind of richness. They are imbued with this richness. Shall call hahanaot haestetiot, with all aesthetic pleasure. Hamangot et haChaim, these things that give honor, that give pleasure to life, the ma'ala elyona ma'od, in an extremely elevated way. These aesthetic things speak to tzaddikim more than to everybody else. V'chusheihem haruchniim, and their sensitivities, their spiritual sensitivities. Afilu b'yachas, even when it comes to the hatochen ha'esteti haragil, even when it comes to pure aesthetics. The hakarat ha'yofi shebemarot, recognizing the beauty in things that they look at. Shebeshira, in poetry. Shebeseder, in order. What does it mean, in order? In appreciating order and structure and architecture and symmetry, shema bedina in the national life of the people, shema musar in direction that is given to people, shema koler in every value. Says so this opposite higher sensitivity mit kaplim b'tfilim adirim. This is doubled and redoubled in these people very significantly. Ad sheheim heim heinam mekorot hayofi b'hasidu b'chem, until they themselves become actually a source of this beauty and this order and this aesthetic coming back down to the world. And here you see this is very, very Kabbalistic in many ways. The tzaddikim are the people who are most able to actually appreciate this world. So that reverberates up the chain to them. And then, because of their power at tzaddikim, underpinning the world, they then feed back this power of beauty and aesthetics back down into the world, so that the true aesthetic and beauty actually is derived and its source comes from these very tzaddikim themselves. To the last paragraph. Baha'olam nizdaher, and then the world will then be purified. Biyofyav, through their beauty, through its beauty. Umitale betifarto, I think talking about the tzaddik, that the world will be elevated by the tiferet. He brings in this idea of tiferet. Al yidei hashba'ah, no, it means that, sorry, the tiferet of the world will be enhanced. Al yidei hashba'ah ziv nishmatam, through the glorious splendor, the luster of their souls. Who's their souls? The tzaddikim. Meaning the beauty and the tiferet of the world will then be enhanced through their souls. But kol balei ha'umnoyot, and look at this. All the artisans and the artists and the sculptors and the designers and all those people in the world, kol balei umnoyot, Shebechochmas hayafot, okay, all of those people who are dedicated in their life to producing beauty, mit'alim, they're elevated through the tzaddikim. Mit'adnim, they are refined, that's the word, refined, adinut, they are refined through that. U'mitbarchim, and they're blessed, alidei hashba'atam, through the influence of these tzaddikim, who are able to fully appreciate the yofi. Kihem ba'atzman, heinam shri'im, because they themselves, these tzaddikim, are imbued, are soaked in b'svirat ha'tiferet ha'elokit, with the Sphira, you know, the Sphira, the idea of the Spheres, their Sphira is Tiferet, a holy, divine-inspired idea of Tiferet. You know the idea of Tiferet is a combination between which Spherot?
Hold on, wait.
It's Chesed and Gevura. It's Chesed and Gevura combined to make Tiferet. Now, we don't usually have these kind of shirim, and you don't usually hear this from me. But, of course, these are very real and important Kabbalistic ideas that Rav Kook is now directing. He's got to finish this piece. What is Chesed and Gevura? Think about this. I heard this idea, I think it was from Rabbi Grovender, but it might have been from someone else. What is Chesed and Gevura? What is Chesed?
Loving kindness.
Not just kindness.
Loving.
Total giving.
Total giving. Chesed means uncontained, unbridled, unlimited outpouring of from you to something else. That's what Chesed is. And what is Gevura?
Absolute restriction.
Restriction and boundary and discipline. If you think about what art is, he's saying art is Tiferet. Mm-hmm. Art is exactly this. It is inspired by a sense of Chesed, which is this enormous creativity, which rises up in a person and pours out in every way, whether it's music, whether it's poetry, whether it's in the visual arts, drama, whatever it is. But if that was all it was, it would just be a load of nonsense. It would just be, you know, blotches of paint on the canvas, and it would just be cacophony. And even modern arts, you know, it's not just people just throwing paint at the wall. That's today. There are systems. Certainly, classical art, classical music, is Chesed extremely disciplined, very, very filled with Gevura. If you apply the Gevura to the creativity of Mozart or Beethoven, or to artists, or to Rembrandt, where every single hair on the Rembrandt painting is a separate brushstroke. Think of the discipline that it takes for Rembrandt to do that. Think of the hours and hours and hours of restrictions and self-control that is needed to produce something quite as inspired and creative. Meaning he's saying that ultimately what art and aesthetic is the sphere of Tiferet, which is Chesed bounded by Gevura. Put it together and you get true art. Wow. Let's carry on. Where are we? Yeah, this is Tiferet. Three, four lines up the bottom. Hakolelet bechativa achad. This Tiferet is able to unite together in one unit. Kol hadrat shamayin va'aretz. All the glory of heaven and earth. The hatiferet, and this Tiferet, holeches, it proceeds. Umit pashetet, and it spreads. Al kol hayitzur, to the whole of creation. Again, what's he saying? The tzaddikim who appreciate the yofi become the source of yofi of tiferet, which goes down to all of creation. Val kol masein, and to every artist and to all their creation. Val kol rachshe libam, and all their imaginations and thoughts. But if you say him, and all their, inclinations and leanings. V'or melech b'yofa v'hoylech u'mitgaleh aleihem. And the lights. A kind of royal light of beauty will be revealed upon them. Now, this is I think this is a very beautiful piece of Rav Kook. This is a very easy piece of Rav Kook. That's why I'm able to understand it and translate. Rav Kook becomes much more complex. But you can see even there from this, the kind of language, Rav Kook is almost a closed book in Chutz La'aretz. It's something, it's almost as if you need Eretz Yisrael for Rav Kook to be kind of activated. You know, America runs on 110 volts, and it just, the machinery just doesn't work. When you get to Eretz Israel and you run on 220 volts, so then already, you know, I think that the Rav Kook really comes alive. It's not a very good mosher because England runs on 240 volts, but you can only take it so far. But Rav Kook, the idea of, well, think about what Rav Kook has done here. Rav Kook is not someone who's saying that all art's good for art's sake and theatre's good for theatre's sake and all the inappropriate stuff that goes on is fine. Of course, God forbid, he's not saying that. But he's saying that don't think for one minute that beauty and aesthetic as an idea is foreign to Judaism. Because it's not. Absolutely the contrary. And I think this is a revolutionary. When are you ever going to hear this from anyone else? And I want to supplement this and complement this with a piece from the Jewish Chronicle that I mentioned before. Rav Kook died in September 1935. Okay? Beginning of September, the 5th of Elul, if I'm not wrong. My kids who went to Rav Kook schools, his yahrzeit is marked every year. They go to Har Zeisim, go to see the Kever of Rav Kook. You should read about Rav Kook. His life was very interesting. There is a good book that I recommend on Rav Kook. It came out recently by a guy called Mirsky, Yehuda Mirsky. And it's called something like something in a revolutionary age, a mystic in a rebellious age, something like that. Put in Yehuda Mirsky, Rav Kook. Did I tell you about that once?
Yeah,
so look, have you read it yet?
No.
Okay, fine. So
what's
the point of me telling you if you don't read the books? So there's another book to read over the summer holiday. You can read it. It's not a long book. You can read it over a couple of Shabbos. About 200 pages, that's all. But it gives you an insight into the life of Rav Kook, a really significant one. There are other books on Rav Kook which are very good. I just picked one up in the Sfarim Sale in the Yeshiva University. I was in the YU Sfarim Sale. You think that I go to America to recruit for Shabbos and Madrasa Rachel? It's all just a cover, actually, for me to be able to get to the YU Sfarim Sale. But
the cover's blown now, Rabbi.
Sorry, the cover's blown now. It's funny that my trips are always just the weeks that they, so I picked up some interesting Sfarim. Actually, one of them is a book, Sefer in English on Rav Kook that I haven't seen before. Anyway, that's not for now. Rav Kook died in early September 1935. A week and a half later, this piece, as a kind of obituary, appeared in the Jewish Chronicle by a fellow called Melnikov. I once gave over this piece in Midrash Rachel, and a girl in the shir said that was my grandfather, which was very interesting. He himself was an artist living in England, and he says the following: as an artist, I am interested in the biblical prohibition of making graven images, which we're going to see in a minute. That has so much influence, had so much influence in the creation of Jewish art. Meaning, Jewish art has not really been a seriously developed form because of so many prohibitions. We'll see what they are in a minute. One day I talked to the late Rabbi Kook about this prohibition. I asked him whether it was true that somewhere in our holy commentaries there is a passage which says that under certain conditions, sculpture is allowed to be done by Jews. The rabbi knitted his brows. He's giving a bit of creative imagery here. I'm not right, exactly. I'm not sure how much you can trust exactly how he reports what Rav Kook did and said, but it's an interesting thing. Let me see, he was saying to himself. There's no doubt in my mind that Rav Kook didn't need to say, let me see. He should go exactly to the Gemara to deal with this. But anyway, a few moments later, he brought down huge Gemarot from the cells. He piled them up on the table. He opened one after the other, moving his delicate fingers along the lines of the Holy Scriptures he read. This went on for half an hour. I don't believe that. Okay. But anyway, whatever. He looked like a hunter on the trail, a hunter after truth and knowledge. At last he stood up triumphantly. Here it is, he said. Now listen to what the sages say about your question. I don't remember the exact wording he quoted, but it was something like this. Our sages say, he read out, that it is allowed for Jews to make images if those are done imperfectly and maimed. This made me laugh. Why are you laughing? He asked. In that case, I replied, I am sure my sculpture is kosher. Why? He asked. Because my work is far from being perfect. Now it was his turn to laugh. He was all kindness. We talked about arts, and he told me the following story. When I lived in London, and when did he live in London? Rav Kook, why would he live in London? The answer is Rav Kook lived in Russia, and he made Aliyah in the early 1900s, 1902, 1903, I believe. He went to be the Rav of Yafo. He became the chief rabbi of Yafo. And in 1914, he was advised by his doctor to take a trip away from Israel to get some rest, because he was obviously working night and day. And he left Eretz Israel to go to Chutz La'aretz for a brief time, and he ended up being caught in the middle of the First World War. The First World War broke out, and he was then prevented from getting back into Eretz Israel, because it's not like, today, you can't just go on a plane. There was a war zone going on, and Eretz Israel was part of the Ottomans, and much of Europe was fighting against the Ottomans. The Germans were siding with the Ottomans, the British were against the Ottomans, and Swiss was neutral. He ended up being stranded, first of all, in Switzerland, which I suppose is not that bad, and then in London, which is not that good. And he was in London for a number of years, and he had a small community in central London. I think he was in the Masjid-e Das in London, and obviously it was a source of great frustration, even depression for Akub, that he was forced to be outside Eretz Israel and stuck in London for years. So he even came north, actually. He went to Harrogate. I live very near a little spa town called Harrogate, and I found with my great excitement that my parents go there every week to, you know, shop, and they go to the, you know, nice things in Harrogate. And Rav Kook actually went there too. He went there to take the you know, the special baths and the spa and all that, because, you know, he was at a certain point really not well and unhappy to be in London. So he says like this: when I lived in London, I used to visit the National Gallery. My favourite pictures were those of Rembrandt. I really think that Rembrandt was a tzaddik. Do you know that when I first saw Rembrandt's works, they reminded me of the legend about the creation of light. The legend, he uses the word legend, this is an old-fashioned word, he means the midrash about the creation of light. We are told that when God created light, it was so strong and pellucid that one could see from one end of the world to the other. Now, the idea of this medrash being it was not a physical light, it was a spiritual light that could give insight as opposed to just sight. The physical light was created by the sun on the fourth day, but light in its spiritual sense was created on the first day, and that's why the midrash is trying to show what kind of light that was. But God was afraid that the wicked might abuse it, as they do spirituality. What did he do? He reserved the light, he reserved that light for the righteous when the Mashiach would come and the Messiah should come. But now and then there are great men who are blessed and privileged to see it. I think, says Rav Kook, that Rembrandt was one of them. And the light in his pictures is the very light that was originally created by God Almighty. Yeah. Now again, you have to give a little bit of poetic license room here. I don't know if these were the words of Rav Kook himself. I have read much about Rembrandt, says the writer here, Melnikov, but none gives such a vivid description of his genius as this. Only a man as pure a heart, pure of heart and soul as Rav Kook, could have seen Rembrandt in that light. Now, it's very interesting, this piece, because there's a little bit of a story to this recently. First of all, I saw that this piece actually appears in the modern-day writings of the students of Rav Kook in yeshivas, Merkaz Harav, etc., where they put together things about Rav Kook that he said. This appears in Hebrew, this section. So this, if you like, has been adopted as being something authentic by the world that actually knows and understands Rav Kook. And secondly, my son, who was at the time when I first discussed this with him, he was in yeshiva in Merkaz Harav, in the high school, Yashlatz, which is the high school, yeshiva high school there, which is attached to Rav Kook's yeshiva, Merkaz Harav. So my son was a bit indignant, and he said, "Oh, I don't believe that Rav Kook would ever say that about Rembrandt. You know, Rav Kook, the great Rav Kook, was going to walk up and down the National Gallery looking at the Rembrandts." He said, "I don't believe it." So I said to my son, "You know something? Why don't you ask the people at school? Ask some of the older rabbis." Now, none of the rabbis at school knew Rav Kook. Rav Kook died in 1935. There aren't really many people alive today that actually knew Rav Kook. You'd have to be, I don't know how old, you'd have to be almost 100 to have actually had a relationship with Rav Kook. But he asked one of the senior rabbonim in the school, and he said to him, "I don't know whether this, how accurate this is, because I never knew, met Rav Kook and talked about it." He says, "But I did know the curator of the Bezalel School of Art." Now, the Bezalel School of Art is a very well-known school of art in Yerushalayim, secular school of art. He said, "And I knew him well, and he knew Rav Kook very well. And I once discussed Rav Kook and art with the head of the Bezalel Art School, and he said he assured me that every conversation he had with Rav Kook knew his art very, very well." And it was something that he'd obviously thought about, studied, and understood. And therefore, I have no reason to believe that this account in the Jewish Chronicle, although I have often reason to doubt the accuracy of things written in the paper, including the Jewish Chronicle, I think can give us some insight into the life of Rav Kook and then the standing of Rav Kook. What's that? That's interesting, but not necessarily in the National Portrait Gallery. And Rembrandt actually painted a lot of Jewish themes as well. Rembrandt lived in Amsterdam, I believe, and actually used a lot of Jews for his paintings. In fact, he lived in Amsterdam around about the same time as Spinoza, if I'm not wrong. And that has interesting ramifications as well as to how all that works, but that's not for now. I think, I hope that this gives, this is really part one, I suppose, and I don't even know whether I should give part two, which is the whole side about the halachic aspects of different kinds of art. If we can do that next week if you're interested in this. But I think as part one, so just to get a feeling for the value of the aesthetic in Judaism, I think there's a lot to be said. If all that you can say is Sheker Achein Behevel Hayoti, I agree that that is a very important statement, but that is really just part of the picture and not the entire picture. I'm not saying that this is the entire picture, but what I've tried to do is find you a broader range of sources that deal with this, and also as an introduction to some of the thought of Rav Kook. I think this is a very valid exercise too. Not that I'm someone to teach Rav Kook, because others are much more able, but whatever I can do, I will do, and hopefully that's of some interest. Okay, let's leave it there.
Can we keep going?
Yeah. You're welcome. Can you send me the recording?